And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting 93.3 in Hamilton on the FM dial and cfmu.mcmaster.ca for the rest of the world via our online streaming service. Now, this week or today, we are having our last program of the year. It's our last live interview. Very pleased to be bringing with us Islamic scholar, journalist, and community leader, Zafar Bengash. Zafar, I was just telling our listeners, it's our last program of the year. It's very appropriate we have you to wrap things up for us because you've been looking at two of the biggest developments that are going to define news in the new year, and I believe that's Pakistan and also the capture of a drone and other incidents in Iran. So thank you very much for being on the program today.
It's my great pleasure, and sorry that it's your last program for the year.
Yes, I know there's probably going to be more things to cover, but the way we see it is there's going to be lots of news in the new year. We just need to be ready for it and understand what's happening, put things into context. Certainly, you've done some of the deep digging and research, looking into matters beyond the news headlines and short bites we get over here. And I guess in terms of headlines and what people are hearing right now, probably one of the biggest issues is the particular drone that is said to be captured by Iran. I guess the question on a lot of people's minds seems to be if the thing is real. But with Obama asking for it back, should we assume that Iran then was able to capture that drone?
Oh, absolutely. What Iran did was so spectacular that without shooting down this plane, which is supposed to be invisible to radar detection because of its particular material that is used and its shape and the electronic gear that is in this particular plane, and it's the higher-end model RQ-170, which means that this is perhaps the most sophisticated plane that you that the U.S. has manufactured. And the fact that Iranian Revolutionary Guards forces of their cyberspace agency, they were able to, first of all, disable the existing program under which this plane was flying, and then introduce its own program into its system and have it safely landed in Iran intact. I mean, absolutely, there is absolutely nothing wrong with this plane now. It's completely intact. That means that Iran has really carried out a remarkable coup against the American war that has been going on for so many years, and in recent years it has naturally intensified as a consequence of these drone operations on Iran. Yeah. But now Iran has got hold of not only this plane, but they have naturally come into possession of a treasure trove of information that its computers have, where this particular plane has been flying, what kind of mapping it has been doing, what its secrets are. And my information is that a number of countries, in fact, are extremely anxious to have a close look at it, including China and Russia and India, and they're all lining up. And as you mentioned, Barack Obama has asked Iran to return this plane. Now, that really takes gall, that, you know, you sent a plane in violation of international law, violation of Iran's sovereignty, and in violation of a treaty that the U.S. had signed with Iran as far back as January of 1981. Many of your listeners probably would not be familiar with that, but I just want to refresh their memory, that at the time when Iran was going to release those Americans that were held by Iran because they were spying, these people were operating under diplomatic cover in the U.S. embassy, and it held them for, we know, 444 days. And when the agreement was signed, in that agreement there was a clause that the U.S. would not undermine the government of Iran or carry out any hostile acts against Iran. Now, this is a clear violation of that agreement. And so, under any rule under any treaty, under any sort of situation, Iran is completely within its right and the U.S. is completely wrong. And so when Obama says that he wants this plane back, what he is indirectly admitting is that, yes, Iran managed to bring this plane down completely safely by overpowering its electronic devices and overriding the plane's electronic systems and implementing or inserting its own electronic information into the plane system and bringing it down safely to the ground.
Well, I think what Obama also is admitting, as you've been indicating, is that if it's plausible that Iran was able to bring down a U.S. drone in Iran, then it means the U.S. is straight out conducting reconnaissance flights over Iran, testing its defenses, mapping its military, and so on. I mean, I think we know what the reaction would be if Iran flew drones into the U.S. The U.S. would go bananas.
Absolutely. I mean, can you imagine if, let's say, either Iranian planes or its ships, et cetera, were either on or in U.S. Territory or territorial waters or anywhere near them, Americans would go berserk, American officials, that is, and their allies. And there would be not only major headlines, but they would be screaming mad and they would want to attack Iran and destroy these these assets that Iran has.
Yes, I was just thinking when you're talking about the treasure trove that this drone represented. Certainly, if they were able to bring it down intact in the manner you suggested, it would contain a lot of information that would be just valuable in general, such as the kind of cameras the drone is using, how well the Americans can photograph installations or to what degree they can see things, what kind of GPS and mapping equipment it contains. So even if whether they're able to access the computers or not, all of the physical mechanisms in that drone will give an indication of the kind of intelligence the U.S. is able to conduct. But overall, it represents a serious investment in trying to determine Iran's military capability.
Yes, absolutely. I think, the fact that, I mean, it is obvious that the U.S. has been conducting these operations for a long time, and at least on one previous occasion, Iran had said that it had brought down a U.S. drone plane over its territory. But I believe that was not brought down intact. In fact, that particular plane was shot down. And again, the Americans had said at that time that the plane had malfunctioned and it had fallen into Iranian territory, with the assumption that perhaps the plane was destroyed, because once it fell down, much of its electronic gear, etc., perhaps was destroyed. The only thing left was its shell. But in this particular case, having brought it down intact, this is a major coup for Iran. And as you pointed out, number one, the Americans have been carrying out illegal surveillance activities over Iran for many years, which are in themselves hostile acts. They have been trying to snoop on Iran's activities, military and whatever, other activities. But now I think Iran has shown that it has sufficient capabilities to be able to neutralize those American activities in a manner in which I think they can probably blind American electronic warfare capabilities should the Americans be foolish enough to carry out an attack against Iran. Although, regrettably, that rhetoric is heating up. There are a number of people, particularly the neocons and the right-wing conservatives in the U.S. and the militarists, that are calling for attacking Iran, because these people thrive on war and causing misery around the world. So their mindset is only on wars, no matter how much damage they do to other countries or even to the United States and its people.
Yes, I think even in the case of this drone incident, it was I think it was Dick Cheney actually who said that there should be an airstrike to destroy the drone. So there should be an attack within Iran.
Can you imagine? I mean, you know, of course, U.S. Military planners considered that option, but ultimately came to the conclusion that it is not going to be as simple as that, because if the U.S. were to carry out such a strike, that there was a very high probability that this would escalate into a full-scale war, and the consequences of that would be absolutely catastrophic, not just for Iran and the U.S., but for the entire world. Because I can visualize the scenario that if there were an attack on Iran, then naturally Iran would not sit idly by. Iran has the capability to carry out a retaliatory strike, and that would be in the entire region, attacking U.S. assets. I mean, the first thing I think Iran would do is to shut off all the oil supplies from the region. And immediately I can see what that would do to the global economy, teetering as it is on the brink of disaster, particularly in Europe and North America. If oil prices were to shoot up to something like $250, $300 a barrel, I think we can say goodbye to Europe and goodbye to the U.S. in terms of its economy, because there will be, fuel prices would skyrocket. There will be absolute riots in the U.S. There, in fact, could even be a civil war because, the U.S. is a very large country, and they are dependent on transportation, transporting food from one part of the country to the other. And if fuel prices are so high, that would immediately escalate food prices as well. And transportation, if it were to ground to a halt, would mean people going hungry and therefore getting very angry. And a hungry man can get angry, and that anger can really explode into a lot of unforeseen consequences.
But there are people in the United States who would benefit from war with Iran, even if it destroyed the domestic situation in the United States. If you're part of a private security company or a military contractor or Homeland Security, now you have more money, more contracts, more power, and more ability to crack down on other movements in the U.S. like Occupy Wall Street, labor unions, anti-war groups, Muslims, as they've been doing with the monitoring campaigns. So a war with Iran, even though it would be more disastrous than recent conflicts, would empower elements that want to crack down on dissent and further fund any military complex.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, if we look at it, the so-called defense contractors and private security companies is a booming industry. Everything else in the U.S. has collapsed, but private security contractors have mushroomed. They have increased in numbers phenomenally, and they would love that kind of a situation. But you see, the flip side of that is that they would also come into conflict with their own people. And that is where I think these people that are salivating at the prospect of attacking Iran should consider whether they want to have a civil war within the United States itself, where they'll be shooting at their own people. And the consequences of that are going to be horrendous for the United States.
Yes, what I'm getting here in a number of ways with the drone situation, as well as what could happen in the Middle East, certainly Iran is no pushover, and evidence has indicated that over and over again. It would be a great undertaking to engage in a conflict. But the U.S., Israel, other Western countries have been trying very hard to destabilize where they can. I know that there's been a series of explosions or blasts in Iran, in its research facilities and elsewhere. There's so many, it's hard to keep up with. Can you tell me about the latest one? I know there was one just this week or last week, I think.
Yes. You see, my reading of the situation is that while publicly American officials, Obama and everybody else, they keep on talking about all options on the table. In fact, what they have been doing is indulging in a massive covert operation whereby they have carried out attacks on Iranian nuclear scientists as well as commanders involved with their missile programs and other activities. So a few weeks ago, there was a missile commander, General Hossein Muqaddam, who was killed in an explosion at a military depot in Iran, and the circumstances of that explosion clearly indicate that it was a sabotage operation. Now, I want to clarify that while both the U.S. and Israel and Britain are involved in these activities, I don't believe that their agents are directly involved. What they are doing is they are financing groups like the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, which incidentally is on the U.S. State Department's list of terrorist organizations, but the U.S. has no compunction dealing with it and using it because hundreds of their operatives are still kept in camps in Iraq, in Camp Ashraf. And as the U.S. thinks of withdrawing its forces from Iraq, there are talks that the residents of that camp, who are basically MKO terrorists, that they'd be taken out of there and relocated to a third country. So the U.S., Britain, and Israel are using MKO terrorists, as well as terrorists belonging to a group called Jundullah, which is a Baloch terrorist organization based in Iran's Sistan, Balochistan province, as well as spreading into Pakistan's Balochistan province, whose leader, incidentally, was captured earlier this year on a flight from, or last year actually, on a flight from Dubai going to one of these Central Asian republics, where he was going to meet Richard Holbrooke, who was also in the region. But as this flight was overflying Iran's airspace, it was an Emirates flight, Iran was able to bring down the flight, force it to land in Iran, and this man, his name was Abdullah Righi, he was captured, put on trial, and then he was executed earlier this year because he was involved in carrying out terrorist activities at the behest of the U.S. And then there are some Kurdish groups that are also involved. So basically, there are three terrorist groups that the Americans, the British, and the Israelis are using to carry out assassination attacks in Iran, as well as sabotage activities at military installations and other places.
Yes. I know the MEK, for example, they've been running a big campaign in Canada and the United States to be taken off the list of terrorist groups since they're on the terror lists. And I mean, I've even seen letters in the local paper of people advocating that the MEK or such groups be removed from the Western list of terror groups. And what you get now is politicians, big league politicians in the United States meeting with some of these groups and saying, please take them off the terrorist list. And they don't give a reason. They don't have a rationale. It's simply the sentiment that they are our terrorists. That's basically it. I saw the article in the Christian Science Monitor, and they talked about those meetings. And later I saw that I think Mayor Giuliani actually was meeting with one such group. And how appropriate that Mayor 9/11 Giuliani there would be consorting with a member of an actual bona fide terrorist organization.
Exactly. Well, that sort of, you know, is quite revealing. You see, that particular group, whom I refer to as MKO, because it's Mujahideen-e-Khalq Organization, or MEK, it's the same group, they actually have offices on Pennsylvania Avenue, a few blocks from the White House, number one. And this group is on the U.S. State Department list of terrorist organizations. I mean, can you imagine Osama bin Laden's group or Al-Qaeda opening shop on Pennsylvania Avenue?
Well, there's not much of a difference between bin Laden and these groups as far as I can tell.
Exactly. You see, this is the thing. And secondly, there are at least 100 U.S. members of Congress that are fully supporting this group. So that means that members of the U.S. Congress are actually sponsoring a terrorist organization. And they talk about fighting terrorism or carrying out this war on terror. In fact, they are actually instigating terror. But these terrorists, as you said, they are their terrorists. As you know, once it had been said, when I think it was during Eisenhower's time, when his advisors said to him that he should support a particularly nasty leader in South America, and Eisenhower said, "But isn't he an SOB? And they said, but Mr. President, he's our own SOB.
Yes.
And so these are exactly the same kind of SOBs of America.
And we've returned to that. After 10 years of a war on terror, they've gone back to just basically openly supporting terrorists. So
absolutely.
That whole war on terror is over. And you saw what they did with the anti-Cuban terrorists who they're harboring still and then not punishing. It's a consistent position they have. But, you know, speaking of terror and attacks and so on, I know we wanted to look at the issue of Pakistan as well. And this has been ignored over the last few weeks or downplayed, even though it's of critical importance. But there's been a number of incidents in which the U.S. has killed or wounded people inside Pakistan or damaged property. And we've covered them on this program. But this is one of the worst we've seen when they killed the 24 soldiers who were at a post. We've always been talking about how people in Pakistan feel about these incidents and how they've been reaching a breaking point. Do you think now have they reached a breaking point?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the people of Pakistan were always absolutely opposed to U.S. policies in the region. It was the ruling elite, particularly the civilians as well as the military establishment in Pakistan, that were in cahoots with the Americans. But this November 26th attack on two border posts near the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. And these two border posts, incidentally, were clearly known to the Americans. All of the coordinates of these posts were given to the Americans. And the attack they carried out lasted for more than 2 hours, in which 24 soldiers, including two officers, a major and a captain, were killed, and 28 other soldiers were badly wounded. Despite the fact that as soon as the attack on these border posts started, the Pakistani military liaison officer immediately contacted his counterpart on the Afghan side, the Americans on the Afghan side, and told them that Pakistani border posts were under attack and that they should stop firing, stop attacking them. And yet these attacks continued for more than 2 hours. So now what has happened is that the Pakistani military in particular was so furious at this attack, this deliberate attack at killing Pakistani soldiers, that they have basically suspended all cooperation with the U.S. military. So what this means is that supplies that used to go through Pakistan to Afghanistan, the supplies of food, fuel, ammunition, etc., from two crossings in Pakistan, they have been brought to a standstill, number one. And only 2 days ago, the Pakistani Prime Minister announced that these will continue until new rules of engagement have been established, and he said that these are not likely to come into force for the next little while.
Yeah, it reminds me of the time the Israelis attacked that UN post in which they killed a Canadian soldier after being radioed. I mean, we'll have to come back to that. We're going to have to see how this holds up in terms of this new arrangement and the attempt to change the rules of engagement or whatnot. We'll see it over the next few weeks, especially how this affects operations. But before we go today, I know there's one thing we really wanted your special commentary on, and I haven't been able to follow this one too well because of all the other things happening. But, of course, there's been this controversy now over the changes to the citizenship ceremony and how Muslim headdress is going to be approached or addressed in this. Can you tell us specifically what the government has done on this?
Absolutely. You know, out of the blue, Jason Kenney, the Minister of Immigration, on Monday, that is on December the 12th, announced in Quebec that he was imposing an immediate ban on Muslim women that wear the niqab or the veil because he said that he had heard complaints from a number of MPs, in which it actually, after further examination, it turned out to be only one. And he said a number of judges had complained, citizenship judges. This is entirely anecdotal. No evidence has been presented. When his office was contacted to see how many women in Wales came for citizenship ceremonies, they had no clue, no idea, no figures, no statistics. And the excuse that Kenny offered was that, well, judges complained that they didn't know whether they were taking an oath, if their faces were covered. I mean, this is so pathetic. We hope that Kenny would grow up, because, you know, these childish excuses do nothing to advance the cause of inclusivity or fairness in this country. I mean, you know, women that cover their faces are a tiny minority. Now, if the concern was that the judges don't know whether these people are actually reciting the oath or not, I mean, there are ways to come around this. But, you know, I want to ask, let's say we know that on these citizenship ceremonies, there are at least 150 to 200 people. does the judge look at everyone's face when they are taking the oath? I mean, the oath is taken collectively. I mean, what kind of absurd arguments are being presented here? It is basically Islamophobia run amok, and it is being given official sanction. Like, you know, let's look at this case. If, let's say, there are some women that are wearing the veil, if the issue is whether they are taking the oath, they are verbalizing the oath, well, they could be taken by a female, you know, citizenship judge in a room, and they would remove their veils and do it. Like, you know, for instance, when these women have their passport photographs taken, they remove the veil. When they go for any security check, they remove their veil. So it's not an issue at all. Nobody has ever raised this issue. Kenny is just playing divisive politics, and he finds that the Muslims are a weak target, and therefore a soft target, and therefore he's indulging in this kind of nonsensical rhetoric, which regrettably the conservative government is famous for or infamous for. I mean, after all, it was Harper himself who in September had said on CBC that Islamicism is the greatest threat to Canada without identifying what Islamicism means. All he did was he made Islamophobia respectable in some segments of the Canadian society's discourse.
Yes, Harper, that government is pounding on Muslims over and over again. I think with the citizenship ceremony case here, it's clearly an initiative from the Harper government, not from the civil service or any advocacy groups. It's just officials in Harper's government that said, let's make another roadblock for Muslims. Let's find another way to make life difficult for Muslims and cause a stir and try to have more anger and controversy directed towards Muslims. As you said, with the case of the veil and facial identification, the Canadian government already has solutions if they need to see people's faces. So this is sort of another unnecessary obstacle, I think.
Exactly.
Well, I'm glad we caught you on that. Overall, I mean, I'm very glad we're able to close out the year with you today. With the situation in Pakistan, for example, we're definitely going to want to see how that unfolds. I know that if you go to an American news site with any article about Pakistan, there's always these hateful messages about Pakistan if you look in the comments. So after Pakistan allows U.S. military aircraft, U.S. installations, U.S. troops on their soil, and so on, you have these killings of Pakistani citizens, and then you have this criticism of Pakistan and whenever you read comments from Americans on news sites. So it seems that this is not a relationship that's sustainable, and I know they're trying to rework that, but we don't know how that's going to go. So we're going to need to check in with you in the new year about that, and also what's happening in Syria and other things. So there's definitely a lot happening at this particular juncture. So, again, it's very important that we're able to understand the context of things coming up for January. And you've been very important in doing that and helping us with that. So, Zafar, thanks so much for being with us on our last live broadcast of 2011.
It's my great pleasure. It's been really, really wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Zafar. Okay. We'll talk to you next year.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that's Islamic scholar, journalist, and community leader Zafar Bengash, also editing and working with Crescent International. I believe you can find that at Crescent Online if you look that up on Google or the Internet. So that's going to be it for this week and this year. We'll be back in January, either the first week or the second week. So we'll see you in the new year.